Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what appears to be a victory for People Power, with an apparent turnaround in Ukraine following an earlier about-face rejection of an agreement for closer ties with the EU. Anders Aslan, the co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics, joins us to discuss Ukraine's President Viktor Yanukovych's latest U-turn and his family's ties to the oligarchy of tycoons who dominate an economy mired in corruption and cronyism. Then we will look into our own cronyism involved in the fire sale of valuable downtown properties belonging to the United States Postal Service that is being deliberately bankrupted by dictates from the U.S. Congress, whose free marketeers want to replace the USPS with postal kiosks in Walmarts. Dr. Gray Breschen, an historical geographer at UC Berkeley, joins us to discuss the exclusive contract that the husband of Senator Dianne Feinstein has with a postmaster general determined to privatize the post office that bestows his company the right to sell off valuable and historic public properties across the country. Then finally, we will get an economic analysis of the consequences of ending unemployment benefits for the jobless on January the 28th. Cutting loose 1.3 million Americans into poverty, with another 1.9 million to come, as a result of the budget deal that Washington is celebrating as a bipartisan success. UCLA Professor of Economics Till von Wachter, who researches labor economics, the economy of aging, and the short and long-term effects of unemployment, joins us to discuss the lack of economic logic to Rand Paul and other conservatives' claim that they are helping people by cutting their benefits. And joining us now is Anders Aslan, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And he is the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. His latest article at the BBC is Ukraine's Crisis, Yanukovych and the Tycoons. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslan.
Thank you.
And apparently there's been another U-turn in this, having had an about-face over rejecting the agreement for closer ties with the EU. It looks like the president of the Ukraine now is at least, I don't know whether he's making another U-turn, but according to the head of the EU, he's told her that he still wants to make the deal with Europe.
Well, I don't think that you should take it seriously. President Yanukovych is all the time saying all the good things, and then he does the opposite. In Vilnius, at the EU summit, his closest aide said hours before Yanukovych didn't sign anything that they were going to sign the full agreement. So Yanukovych simply has a habit of saying the opposite of what he actually does.
But there is underway a unprecedented, I think, demonstration of people power, is there not? He is surrounded. The opposition have occupied these main squares in Kiev. They have erected extremely sophisticated barriers. They seem to be very well organized. They seem to be determined. And all he's got is the riot police, right?
Indeed. I think that he has really painted himself into the corner. I totally agree with the spirit of your question, that it's amazing that he's not trying to compromise. But I presume that he realizes that he has gone too far, that he's in a dead end. And as you say, he has a few thousand riot police. The big businessmen have turned against him. And in the latest opinion poll before the protest, he had only 17% wanting to vote for him if there were presidential elections 1 month ago.
But in terms of your recent article at the BBC, Anders Aslan, Ukraine Crisis, Yanukovych and the Tycoons, what is underway then? Because the subtext in many ways for this second Orange Revolution, if that's the right way to describe it, is the widespread revulsion amongst most Ukrainians at their crony capitalism and corruption that is exemplified by Yanukovych's oldest son, Alexander, who is basically, I guess, is he getting kickbacks from the oligarchs? How does it work? Is it a trickle-down system of kickbacks, or is it rather like what you have in Russia under Putin, where he's the kind of capo di capo. He regulates the oligarchs. And a lot of reports indicate that he will retire, if he ever does, as one of the richest men on the planet.
Well, there's a big difference. Putin does exactly what you say. He operates as a godfather among the big businessmen. Yanukovych is not as wise as Putin. He wants to get it all himself. And his son then goes on to the big businessmen and says, for example, you and I are partners now. I own half of your enterprise, and you only own half of it. And that is very unpopular with the big businessmen. They are making money by buying enterprises cheaply in privatizations when there is only one buyer. They are forcing all kinds of businessmen, also the very big ones, to sell enterprises. They get the price, but the price that is being decided by the family and not by an open market. Half of the Western banks in Ukraine have already fled, and they are mostly sold out to representatives of the family, the Yanukovych family, and the other half of the West European banks are on the market because Yanukovych has seemingly intentionally made the business environment so awful that West European banks can no longer operate in Ukraine.
So this is the kind of looting that is one is sort of used to in the third world. So how different is it then in the second world, if indeed you can categorize the Ukraine as being a part of the second world?
Well, this is really very much like the third world. It's a family dynasty that Yanukovych has built up. So it's much more backward structurally than President Putin's role in Russia, where there are certain rules. You're not allowed to be political, but you can keep your fortune as long as you stay acceptable to President Putin. In Ukraine today, even the most powerful businessmen who have been close to President Yanukovych for years are now feeling that they have to give up enterprises to Yanukovych and his family.
Now, in terms of the title of your book, Anders Aslan, it doesn't seem to be ringing true with our conversation, right? You're talking about a market economy and a democracy, when in fact in our conversation so far you're talking about an oligarchy and a plutocracy.
This book was published in 2009 when Ukraine still was a democracy. And you can also see that Ukraine is a much freer society than Russia, that the opposition has about 40% of the seats in the parliament. The protests are now being broadcast by three parallel television channels all the time. The oligarchs are now covering with the big television channels the protests quite objectively. And Ukraine has abolished visas for Western people, so one can travel very freely there. So Ukraine is a much freer and a more open society than Russia is still. But the economic mismanagement, as I discussed, has been quite awful for the last couple of years under President Yanukovych.
So is there any justification to Putin's objections that if the Ukraine joins the EU, they will therefore flood Russia with EU products?
No, there's none whatsoever. If you have a free trade agreement, then you have something called rules of origin, that is only products from your country that can enter the other country without tariffs. So President Putin and his aides clearly don't know much about trade policy, nor do I think that they care about it.
Well, what they do know about, though, is blackmail and naked thuggery, if you will. They're willing to turn off the tap. They've turned off the gas pipeline that goes through the Ukraine to Europe, which is one of their main sources of revenue. So they can play hardball.
Oh, sure. But I would rather emphasize that Russia tends to shoot itself in the foot all the time. It tries now to push countries into a customs union, which is highly protectionist. If Ukraine would join it, its GDP would fall further, and it would get all kinds of conflict with other countries. The Russian market is anyhow totally unreliable, so it's not that you benefit anything. Ukraine has sharply reduced its imports of gas from Russia because it's so unreliable, and Russian gas from the state-controlled gas giant is losing out very seriously on all markets because it misbehaves so much. So I think that this cost President Putin a lot and his country, and it doesn't make much sense. He would be much better advised to try to be more peaceful and try to develop his economy. Instead, we are seeing that the Russian economic growth is coming close to zero now.
And what he's offering the Ukraine in this customs union, of course, is joining countries such as Belarus and Kazakhstan, which are hardly thriving economies, with free and open democratic expression. They're, at least in the case of Belarus, it's almost an anachronism. It isn't, goes back to the Cold War.
Indeed, and also the Russian arguments are that Ukrainian produce is so bad that it can't compete in Europe, and therefore it should try to sell on the Russian and Kazakh markets where much worse products are accepted. It's hardly an attractive appeal.
So how do you separate out then, Anders Aslan, the economics from the politics? Because it does seem that Putin is an entirely political animal. You know, we're making the assumption now that he's in many ways trying to pull the strings here, if he's not in fact doing that. He's obviously incapable of advancing Russia, but he seems to be obsessed with trying to diminish America. And this paranoia about NATO moving east, I thought that was pretty much settled. We're not talking about Georgia and Ukraine joining NATO, as John Bolton is arguing in a piece in the Los Angeles Times. We're talking about an economic integration into Europe. Does it have any military and political aspects to it, this EU deal?
Not really. There is an EU security policy, but nobody would take it seriously. So this is really just a negative attitude, and if Russia would be rational, Russia would try to get a free trade agreement with Europe exactly as Ukraine. Now Russia is preoccupied by harming other countries, and if you look up on it, Moldova and Georgia, they did sign deep and comprehensive free trade agreements now with the European Union, and they are not suffering any Russian repercussions. So instead, it's Ukraine that hesitated and didn't sign that is suffering from the Russian trouble. And this is what President Putin is offering, all sticks and no carrots, and you don't attract people in that way.
But is Putin and, to some extent, Yanukovych acting out of the fact that they don't want any kind of transparency? If you have this rampant crony capitalism and this one family in the Ukraine is basically stealing the country blind to the point where even the oligarchs are in revolt against them, are there any measures in this EU agreement that would enforce the kind of transparency that would expose Yanukovych and his family to even more sunlight and, by extension, Putin?
Indeed, this is the critical factor. So there were two conditions that Yanukovych was not prepared to fulfill of the EU conditions for the association agreement. One was to let Yulia Tymoshenko, the run-up presidential candidate in the last elections that Yanukovych defeated with a tiny margin, to keep her, to let her out of prison, where Yanukovych has put her for 7 years for purely political reasons. And the other condition that it didn't fulfill, it was to adopt a law on prosecution, because Ukraine still have an old Soviet system of prosecution, where the prosecutor, believe it or not, is superior to the judge. So the prosecutor can change a court verdict to the benefit of political repression if he so desires. So these were the two conditions Yanukovych refused to sign. So my sense is that Yanukovych, all what he said that he would sign, had decided long ago, I'm never going to sign this because it will diminish my possibility of arbitrary rule in this country. At the same time, he wanted to say that he was going to sign because otherwise the big businessmen would revolt against him. The big businessmen are not afraid of European competition. They are afraid of Yanukovych and his family stealing, in the literal sense, the enterprises from them.
But isn't one of the reasons why Yanukovych came back in this last election, where apparently it was free and fair, is because of the divisions and the almost ridiculous infighting in the amongst what is now the opposition, but was originally the Orange Revolution that swept the reformers into power? I mean, Yanukovych is actually poised to go down in history as the only man to be kicked out twice by people power, right?
Well, it's an interesting observation. Of course, the Orange government was quite bad, but and it was in a steady stalemate. But a major reason for this was that President Viktor Yushchenko, the winner in after the Orange Revolution, went over to Yanukovych's side and worked in the elections in 2010 and the parliamentary elections 2012 as a provocateur for Yanukovych. That is, he pushed a hard nationalist line in order to take Yulia Tymoshenko further to the nationalist side than she wanted to go, and also to deter people in the East so that they would vote more for Yanukovych. And the proof of it is that former President Yushchenko, who was perceived as the main enemy of Viktor Yanukovych, still lives in the presidential residence outside of Kiev at a public cost of $3 million a year. So the relationship between Yanukovych and Yushchenko is that good. Yushchenko is simply paid by Yanukovych. And we don't know when this started. But sometimes during President Yushchenko's tenure, during the last 2 years, he vetoed virtually every decision that Prime Minister Tymoshenko took. And since Yushchenko was the main hero of the Orange Revolution, people do not want to say this in public, but this is the truth.
Well, this is pretty extraordinary, isn't it? It's almost Shakespearean, the idea that a guy who was poisoned by Yushchenko and the dark forces there ends up being bought by him and living under his roof.
Quite extraordinary.
It is extraordinary.
Yeah, so nobody wants to talk about Yushchenko now. He's just disappeared from the public eye. Well, he has actually popped up a little bit in the last few days, but apart from that, he has been gone.
Well, Anders Aslan, we have to leave you now, but I guess we can at least be a little optimistic that so far people power is winning, right?
Yeah, I'm very hopeful, but it's also involving great risk. So Yanukovych clearly wants to try to clamp out and tire out the opposition. And if they lose, then they will end up in large numbers in prison, so they had better not lose out, and the way of doing so is on the one hand to be peaceful, on the other hand to be out in hundreds of thousands so that Yanukovych's thousands of riot police can't change the situation.
Well, I thank you again for joining us, Anders Aslan.
Thank you very much, Ian. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. Again, I've been speaking with Anders Aslan, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And he's the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. And his latest article at the BBC is Ukraine Crisis, Yukanovich and the Tycoons. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the cronyism involving Senator Feinstein's husband and the Postmaster General, a free marketeer, who is giving away historical public properties at fire sale prices.